session number 18362, Reel 1.
Rhonda Levine, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Camden Town.
Which year was this?
In April 1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Camden Town?
Yes, I grew up in Camden Town.
How old were you when you left school?
I went to art school at 16, St Martin's School of Art.
And
I left in 1939, bummed around for a couple of months, and then was conscripted into the army.
Do you remember the date that you were conscripted?
Yes, it was in the war was September, a couple of months after, about a couple of months after.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
I was quite shocked. I was on a bus with a very dear old friend of mine, and a woman dashed on and she said, "Oh, have you heard a war has been declared?" I can't say I was stunned because, you know, it was obviously coming, but it shook me. And when I got home, my father, who was a Frenchman, was in tears, you know, at the thought that the Germans would eventually overrun his country. And it was quite a day. And I had to go down and collect my brother's daughter from school. And that was my first day, the first day. And then there was that air raid warning, you know, the fateful air raid warning.
Which part of France had your father come from?
Ah, now here's a story. My father was born in Italy of French parentage, of a French father and Italian mother. He was never naturalized an Italian. His father wanted him to grow up to be a Frenchman. His father was had his own college, actually, and he was a professor of languages. Then my father was one of two brothers, one very academic, the other, my father, more of an adventurer. My father then decided to come to England, but unfortunately for him, when he got to France, being a French nationality, he was nabbed for the French army. Whereupon he was sent to French Indochina and had a pretty rough time there. I remember him telling me about captured pirates being beheaded, which was a sight which happened to me of seeing prisoners of war beheaded, but that's another story. So he did his service in there, tried to desert, got as far as getting onto the ship to go to South America, but were betrayed by somebody, and therefore did another year's service in Indochina. He then left and went to Paris and stayed there, having a rather adventurous time. His brother by this time, as I've mentioned, was an academic and was quite a well-known man in France. Tried to persuade him to be a good man, but no, he said, "No, I'm going on to England." Came to England. I can't remember what his first job was. A man of great education, my father, but he potted around. Then he met my mother, who I must tell you this. My mother was a simple London girl who I don't think had ever been further than Hampstead Heath from Camden Town, where she was born. But Mr. Wood, she started work as a young girl in an Italian milliner's shop, hat makers. And nobody spoke English in the shop. They're all Italian girls in Soho, and the madam was Italian, and the master was Italian. And my mother said, I want you to say everything in Italian to me. Pick up an object. And so I said, and she said she got on quite well. Then she met my father, who was very fluent in several languages, and my father taught her grammatical Italian, and he taught her French. And Mr. Wood, my father had an Italian friend over here, a professor of languages too, And he said to my mother during course of dinner, this was before I was born, of course, I'll tell you where you come from in Italy. He thought she was Italian. He said, you have a perfect Tuscan accent. Absolutely beautiful, he said. My father was born in Livorno in Tuscany. And of course, she was very pleased at that. And it was marvellous. And then we were a happy family. I had six brothers, one sister who died a couple of years ago. And I am the last of that breed, the last. And then, of course, my father died, I think, without knowing that I was alive. It was very upsetting to me when I heard that. And then into the army, a training regiment in Sussex, in Brighton. And then I was posted to the 88th Field Regiment, which was a North Country regiment. All the men were from Bolton and Manchester, and a beautiful lot of guys they were.
Is this Royal Artillery?
Yeah, Royal Artillery, 88th Field Regiment.
And can you tell me how you came to go to the Far East, please?
How I came to, yes. Well, we did all our training there. Some of the men in the regiment, poor devils, had only just come back from Dunkirk. And as I say, they were a marvellous regiment. And then one day they said, they gave us leave and said, you will be going abroad. They didn't tell us where. And we packed up and took all our gear to Gourock on the Clyde. And from there we boarded ship, the Empress of Canada, which was later sunk, so I heard. And we went in one of the largest convoys to leave England, having great new ships like the Dutch New Amsterdam and the Dominion Monarch, a new refrigeration ship, sailed alongside us. We were accompanied by, was it the Repulse or the Renown? The one that was sunk off the coast of Malaya while we were there fighting with the Prince of Wales.
That was the Repulse.
Through Mr. Churchill, because he wouldn't insist them going without aircraft carrier cover. And that was that. So I ended up in Singapore, which before the Japanese started war with us, and I think we had quite a few weeks there, you know, sort of in a camp just outside Singapore. And then, of course, the Japanese started, and we were alerted, and off we went up jungle. A very sad thing here. We had a lovely Major Kelly, who gave us a terrific lecture, because, you know, he was a man, all face facts. Some blokes thought he was hard. I thought he was a marvellous man. And he gave us a lecture. He said, look, we're going up to fight the Japanese. He said, we were told by our government that the Japanese could not get through the jungle. That's why the big guns at Singapore faced the sea, and which was the cause of our downfall, of course. And he said, now remember, some of us are not coming back. He said, so I'm going to wish you all the best of luck. And this, and we all gave him a great cheer. He was a marvellous man. Marvellous man. The first man to be killed. Major Kelly. First man of our regiment, anyway. And we went up to Malaya. We had a big fight at Kuala Lumpur.
Can you describe the action you were...
Yes, in? I can. I remember that particular one. We had to cross a river, Mr. Wood, and it was an old wooden-type ferry, you know. It's quite wide enough to take a gun truck and its tower, you know, the quad, as we called them, and our guns, which were the larger 25-pounders. And we took three trucks at a time onto this buddy. And we were halfway across. No, we were just going across, a few yards out. And suddenly, we saw two Japanese planes circling right at the head of the river. So we thought, right, we got under the trucks. I was in the centre truck, my gun and truck there. The others managed to sort of scramble off and leap ashore. But two colleagues and I were under this gun and we couldn't get out because there were fellows running either side. You see, we couldn't get out. And I can remember Mr. Wood lying with my chin on my hands under this truck, watching these two planes coming down the river, firing like mad at us. So I pulled our helmets down and we heard the bullets, we saw the bullets splashing along the water, bing dong, ding dong, hitting the trucks like that. And, you know, believe it or not, when they passed, they gave us two attacks with their guns, and they passed and they flew off. And when we got out, the trucks either side of my truck were absolutely riddled with bullets, and our truck was barely touched. Now, had they have gone through the floor of the trucks like the ones behind and before us, we would have been, you know, shot to pieces. Anyway, we made it, and we got the guns across. And then, of course, it was the sad and bitter story of the war in Malaya, because wherever we went and set up action, it was prepared to withdraw.
Was that incident that you described near Kuala Lumpur?
Yeah. Prepare to withdraw. And we had several situations like that. Once we were practically surrounded by the Japanese, and we were extremely lucky to get out there. And I remember using open sights on some Japanese tanks. And it's an odd feeling, Mr. Wood. They're your enemy. But I remember, and I don't know, I was an art student, but how I became the number one gun layer and gun layer in the battery, I don't know, but I did. And I can remember laying my sights on these Japanese vehicles and tanks and sitting there, pulling the firing lever and watching them blow up. But even though they were my enemies, it was a bit, I thought, living men. But then I thought, well, if I didn't get them, they would get me. And that was that. And that is the story. And then further down Malaya, I don't know where exactly, we heard the terrible news that the Prince of Wales and the Repulse had gone down. And I must mention here that later on in our camp in Japan, a few of the sailors were transferred to our camp who were from the Prince of Wales. Nice chaps. And then, of course, it went on, and the battle got worse and worse, and we were beaten back. We were beaten all the way, Mr. Wood. The Japanese can't get through the jungle. They came through like monkeys, as easily as all that. A few little fearsome nights and days which didn't concern shells and bullets. I remember one night we were so exhausted, we drove through a village which was ablaze, you know, how the flames were licking the side. I thought the petrol tanks on the trucks would go up. They didn't. We got through the village, and we were so exhausted that we got to a large rubber plantation. And the sergeant said, come on, lads, let's put up for the night here. And we threw out the ground sheets on the floor. When we woke up in the morning, you have no idea how many large, not the golden, the black centipedes, they must have crawled over us in the night. There were hundreds of them. These centipedes. So many that the Indian and Tamil workers, the labourers on the rubber plantation, used to go to work with sticks, you know, killing them as they went along. So that was a night that the Japanese didn't kill us, but the centipedes nearly did. Anyway, we got, and that was the story, you know, we prepared to withdraw. Fire, and then prepare to withdraw, all the way back to Singapore. Now, on the night before the war ended, was rather a fearsome night, because our gun got bogged down in mud, and we had to go crawl back across a field and got some bits of timber and logs to put them out. Now, the snipers were out, because this was just on the outskirts, suburbs of Singapore. And they were pinging us. And I remember crawling on my belly through the grass, you know, grass, dragging bits of wood and trucks to put under the tyres. And eventually we got out of there and drove down the street with quite a few shells falling around and so on. And we put up, we were so exhausted. I don't know where our other guns were. They'd gone off somewhere else. But my sergeant, God bless him, a beautiful North countryman, Numberland. Never forget his name, Geordie Swinhoe, an old Indian Army sergeant. Treated me like a son, marvellous old man. Well, he was old to me then. And we drove into the courtyard of a rather swanky, obviously a rich Malayan's house, or maybe a white, an Englishman's house, I don't know. And we towed the gun into the courtyard, threw ourselves down, put a guard on, and we slept. Quite a peaceful night. Woke up in the morning, and I was, and this, you maybe you will find, you won't, because you've heard these stories before, but a lot of people find this hard to believe. You know, the trailer on a gun, we got up, smoked a cigarette, the boys, I was sitting on the trailer just like this, and about this height, another lad there and another lad there, I lit up a cigarette. They always say you never hear the one that's going to get you, which is true with a shell. Suddenly there was this flash and blast, and Mr. Wood, that shell, believe me, fell no further than that lampshade or the television. And what we sort of came out, and there was this great gaping hole. One of the boys, I like that, one of the boys had his head blown off. That was awful, had his head blown off. Two had minor scratches. And so the sergeant said, look, we've got to take shelter. And there were large monsoon ditches just a little way from the courtyard where we were sheltering. And the sergeant said, let's get in those ditches. So we took a running jump into this mud and slime in the ditch. And once again, some planes coming up the road, they'd spotted us and they were firing, but fortunately the bullets missed the ditch. And there was like a drain going through there, so we crawled into the drain. And then I realised, the sergeant said to me, Christ. And when I looked down, the blood was literally pouring down my arm and my leg. And in the panic and the moment of almost horror and terror of this big attack, I really for a moment I thought I'd lost my arm. You know, it was just blood red. And sergeant said, look, I've got to get you to hospital in Singapore. So they waved a truck down, which was careering down the road of some other regiment. And he said, look, are you going near the hospital? They said, yes. They said, drop him off. So I left the, I left my regiment, jumped in the truck, and went into the hospital. And Mr. Wood, there was the most marvellous young doctor. I hope he's alive. I'd love to meet him. Okay. He was a marvellous young doctor, and he said, look, he said, the Japanese are at the gates. He said, so I can't take all your metal out. I had two pieces in there.
In your thigh?
One shrapnel from the shell, two pieces here.
On the other thigh.
And you can feel, but there were two big...
Careful of the microphone.
Two big pieces here.
In your shoulder?
In there.
Collarbone?
Yes, which when I had my x-rays for my lungs, the doctor said, what's this, Mr. Delamine? And I said, my God. He said, they're two quiet pieces. He said, but they're lodged, and I advise you not to have them out. He said, I would leave them there. He said, and do that. So anyway, the doctor, he withdrew these rather long slivers of metal here and that, and he stuck some things on. And he said, now go, he said, because they're almost at the gates. And I went, as I came out, he called me back. And he said, are you armed? I said, no. So he gave me a large service revolver. And I shall always remember him. He called me back again. And he said, I forgot to give you ammunition. And he stuffed a load of ammunition in my shirt pocket. And he said, and good luck to you. Be careful. So I was dazed. I went out, and when I got onto the main road, there were bangs and shells and God knows what. I've got to get out of this. And on the opposite side was I should know, but I don't, Mr. Wood. The house is built on wooden piles to keep them away from spiders and ants. And I looked across, and there were a lot of fellows sheltering beneath the hut. So I thought, I'll go over there. At the very moment that thought flashed through my mind, a shell hit it, and that was the end of them. They went. So where do I go from here? I didn't know where my regiment was. There were a few soldiers milling around, running here and there. And then...
This is actually in Singapore.
In Singapore, yes, in Singapore. And a truck came down, so I said, could you give us a lift? Hurry up, mate. Where are you going? I said, I'm looking for the 88. Know where they are, he said. I know where they are. So he drove me down to almost near the beach, where our guns were, and I was there sort of patched up and adjoined them, and they said, we'll blow our own gun, we'll blow the guns up. And we put a shell down the spout and put a lanyard on. I couldn't do it because I couldn't use my arm. And they pulled the lanyards, and of course they split the gun barrels. And then they said, right, a surrender. There'd been an unconditional surrender, and that's it. So it was very, very, there was a lull. And then some blokes must have been further along the coast, fired guns. So the Japanese retaliated and did another bombing raid. Then it quietened down, and everything was peaceful. Now, later on that evening, we all accumulated near the, there was a club, I think it was called the Union Jack Club for the troops, somewhere near the Raffles Hotel. And I shall never forget that night, Mr. Wood. It was like, almost a bit like a Kafka novel, you know, you were in a situation, but you didn't know why you were there. I mean, what, you know. And I can remember looking over at this water and seeing fat, bloated bodies floating by, and cattle and all sorts of things. It was a nightmare. And this massive, strong smell of whiskey. Some shells had obviously fallen into the Union Jack Club, into a cellar, and there was this great whiskey. Of course, some of the boys rushed over there and found a few bottles unbroken. So you can guess that they had a good drink. And in the morning, there was a whole sort of mixed hordes of soldiers milling around, and I couldn't find this part of the regiment. Where's my regiment? And someone said, you are the 88th. I said, yes. So he said, well, look, if you go down, I forget the road, but he said, you go down the road over there, turn right, you'll come to a big sports field. He said, a lot of artillery men are there. And now this is my first contact with a Japanese soldier. There were three of us. And we started walking down the road, and suddenly three rather severe and savage-looking Japanese soldiers came round the corner and advanced towards us with their bayonets fixed. Got us against the wall, gave us some rather nasty prods with their bayonets, and started shouting and shrieking in Japanese, which of course we didn't understand a word of. And I thought, well, you know, this is it. And we tried to explain, you know. So in the end, I don't know whether my little trick, I pointed to my regimental colours, the blue and red diamond of the artillery, that's out that, you know, and I said, down there, they discussed something in Japanese, and then they prodded us again and pushed us against the wall. And then, much to my amazement and my friends, they just said, and they let us go. And walking down that road, Mr. Wood, I expected any moment, I said to them, I said, don't, I said, we may get it now. You know, I thought perhaps that they would wait for us to start walking down the road and fire at us. But they didn't. And we got to the camp, which was absolute madness, soldiers milling around and wounded and God knows what. And there, you know, it was just absolute mayhem. From there, we were given orders to march to Changi prison. That's quite a march. Now, there were many, many wounded men. Some dropped by the wayside. I often wonder what happened to them. And, you know, if you went to help anybody, you were dug with a bloody pickaxe handle or something like that. And a lot of them dropped on the way. I think some got eventually made their way there, some didn't. Anyway, we got to the camp, and believe it or not, the Japanese made us barbed wire ourselves in. They couldn't be bothered. So we left what we thought might be handy, a few loose gaps in the wire, which did prove to be handy.
Did you do that yourself?
Yeah, we had wired ourselves in, and the Japanese patrolled, but whenever they weren't there, you know, we left a bit of loose wire around. And we stayed in that camp for some time. And at night, some local Chinese risked their lives. They were the sort that were beheaded too. They would bring eggs, and we were trading any little object for some eggs and food. And then things went very quietly for a few weeks. The Japanese, you know, we didn't see much of the guards or anything like that at all. And then that went on for a few weeks, I don't know, maybe a month. And then we were told to parade, and we were going to be to different parts of the Singapore on the outskirts to work for the Japanese. And one of the jobs I was on was going out, and we had to tow broken and bombed cars back where they were disassembled and the parts used by the Imperial Japanese Army. And it was on this particular site where I got my first picture of what Japanese brutality was like. And I can remember Mr. Wood being on one job, and I was so close to these poor men. There were a couple of Chinese and a Malay, and they were spread-eagled, like standing between two trees like this, and they were putting electric wires around their testicles, in their ears like that, and they were switching on. And we had to work and to hear the screams coming from those poor men. And not only that, but on the other side of us, there was a large attack hut. And they were torturing people in there. And you know, it was just awful. You know, I don't know how we got through that period. Day after day after day, we were doing it. And then we had to construct these wooden, like, two-storied go-downs, they call them. Don't they? Go-down.
What had these torture victims supposed to have done?
Pardon?
What are the torture victims supposed to have done?
The charges against them.
Yes.
Oh, that was like that paint. I'm going to show you a painting. You see, you would... now, it was during this period where on the road back to our camp, you would see wooden stakes in the ground with heads stuck on them. This man stole a rubber tire. This man was a liar and a thief. This man was dishonest. This man did not bow to a Japanese officer. And you know, Mr. Wood, the terrible thing is, seeing that day after day, one became used to it. You know, you sort of, it no longer became an horrific thing to you. And flies buzzing round them and all this thing, you know, this sort of thing going on. And we did several jobs in various places like this, you know, and seeing these instances of brutality. And then we went to another job where we had to clear some marshland. Highly dangerous job, because I remember picking some logs through in this slime and mush and seeing one of the worst of centipedes, a golden centipede, two of them walking towards my hands. I said to the chap at the other end of the log, look, I'm going to count three. When I get to three, drop, which we did. And, of course, we dropped it and there. And there were leeches and things like that. It was a bad, bad spell. But I lived. I got through it. I got through it, you know? A lot of chaps, you know, one day they would look fit and the next day they would become very broody, and a lot of them would talk about food. I've never been a big eater.